With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
Hey everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to or you're just about to listen to. We'd love to keep the lights on a bit longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights on the website and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. So just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
To get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
The TARDIS Crew, a Doctor Who podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm Baz Greenland, and I'm joined in my adventure through time and space by my son Ben, who is the biggest Doctor Who fan this side of Gallifrey. How are you, Ben?
Hello, yes, I am very good, thank you.
Excellent. So, in our primer episodes, I asked you to pick a topic for our first full episode of the TARDIS Crew, and you know, I'm sure many people were wondering if we were going to cover a classic story like Genesis of the Daleks or Pyramids of Mars or maybe a modern masterpiece like Day of the Doctor. But no. You chose Time Lash for our first episode.
Well, yes, indeed I did. Because I actually unironically love it. So there we go.
Oh, there you go. I was going to ask, what was the decision? You know, I was going to say, I guess that's what happens when you put a 15-year-old in charge of the decision-making. So the aim of this episode, then, is to present a much maligned story like Time Lash and give it something of a redemptive spin, because even bad Doctor Who, being Doctor Who, has some good moments. So you mentioned, you kind of discussed it briefly, but what was your reasoning for picking Time Lash as our first episode?
Well, I genuinely really loved the story, and I know a lot of people sleep on it. Not as much as one like The Twin Dilemma, but it's still got a very terrible reputation, and I think I can justify why I enjoy it more than some of the more overrated stories of the show.
So you were here for the defence to acquit Time Lash of its crimes in the Doctor Who lore?
Yes.
Excellent. So I'm actually quite a Frog Time match too. It certainly has its issues, but for me, I think it's one of the more entertaining stories of the Sixth Doctor era on TV. So shall we delve more into the story then? Time Lash was the fifth story of Doctor Who season 22 and made up the 10th and 11th episodes of that season. It was a period of time when the show was deviating from its classic format of 25-minute episodes and showing 45-minute adventures. So as a two-parter, Time Lash is the same length roughly as the four 25-minute episode stories. Though I believe in some countries it may have been shown in a 25-minute format.
It's possible, although don't quote me on that.
Yeah. So these are two, this is the 45-minute episodes then. The story was written by Glenn McCoy in his only credit on the show, as far as we're aware, and directed by Pennant Roberts and starred Colin Baker as the Sixth Doctor and Nicola Bryant as Perry. It's also regarded as one of the worst Doctor Who stories of all time. But is it that bad? So, Ben, you've read a lot of forums, you've read deeply into this, and I think there was a reason why you wanted to discuss this episode. So what are the main arguments you've read for Time Lash being so utterly terrible?
So I have seen many complaints due to overacting, bad set design, which admittedly it was the budget episode of the season, and just not a very fun plot, if you like, in general.
Yeah, I can see some of those criticisms. The set is quite bland. There are moments I like. I like the tunnels that Perry gets trapped in. They're a bit more effective. But yeah, it's very, very bland, and everyone is in beige, I think. Apart from the Doctor, there's no one in colour. You've got the android in the pastels and the blue face. But I think that's really it. It's a bit of a bland story, and some of the performances are a little over the top, but I'm also quite fond of them as well.
Although, if we're honest, the Doctor more than makes up for all the colour we miss in the story.
There's a lot of colour in that Doctor's coat. So, actually, before we get into this, so what are your thoughts on the Sixth Doctor on TV?
On TV, he doesn't fare as well as he does in other mediums like Big Finish, I'll be honest. He can be very abrasive and rude, and yet I still really like what they were going for with this Doctor. They just didn't do it in a way which made other people truly fall in love with him. Indeed, they hated him.
Yeah, I think it's a bit what we were doing with Capaldi, weren't they? They made Capaldi very rude and very brash, and I know as a result, some people weren't very fond of Series 8 when he came on, but and there's definitely a sense of that Sixth Doctor element to him there, but I do think there were moments with the Sixth Doctor. Yeah, you're right, he's absolutely better on Big Finish. He's really good, but he's very rude here, and I've never particularly been fond of his relationship with Perry. Again, a little bit better on Big Finish, but I find Perry comes across as very, very whiny with the Sixth Doctor. He becomes very, very rude and abrasive, and it's actually not that fun to watch that relationship. I do think Time Lash has some good Sixth Doctor moments. I was actually, when we were watching it for this podcast, I was thinking, actually, I quite like him. He actually is the hero of the story, you know, more in the vein of Hartnell, which he was inspired by. You know, he's definitely his usual aggressive, cold Doctor. But maybe because it's towards the end of his first full season, there are hints of warmth coming in as well.
Mm. He definitely does drive the narrative, as the Doctor should. He's not as much of a background character, although is it ever possible for a Doctor this loud and colourful to ever be a background character?
Well, there's one thing about Time Lash, isn't it, is that, like a lot of Classic Doctor 2, particularly Sixth Doctor, I've noticed, it takes a while for him to come into the story. There's a lot happening in the story before the TARDIS arrives at the planet.
Mm. It definitely feels like the TARDIS scenes are a very 25-minute episode 1 type of format for the Doctor and Perry, and it usually does take about halfway through for them to arrive. Think Attack of the Cybermen or Vengeance on Varos.
Yeah, so maybe actually the 45-minute episode format works in this case, because otherwise you'd have 25 minutes of the Doctor and Perry bickering on the TARDIS, which isn't always the most fun thing to watch.
I don't mind it, but it probably would get very overdone as it went on.
Yeah, and actually I think, for me, I think some of the worst stuff actually in the episode is the TARDIS stuff. The TARDIS stuff is very dragged out, particularly in the second half.
I've never not liked the TARDIS scenes. I've been quite a fan of them, but it's definitely better to balance that out with the actual plot of the story.
Yeah. And I think this is where I think the strength of Time Lash lies. There is a good story here. I think that Glenn McCoy actually did a pretty decent script here. You get a real sense of the kind of world building on the planet, this threat of invasion, the political schemes and machinations and the rebel attacks as well. There's a lot going on. And I think you definitely will get a sense of the conflict and tension running throughout the place before the Doctor arrives.
Oh yes, very much so. I mean, before the Doctor even arrives, we've had the first Maylin already cut down by the Borad, so there's definitely enough going on for the Doctor to get straight into the action. Because I'll be adding insult to injury, I think, if it took this long for the Doctor to get there, and then when he arrives, he's still walking around for 25 minutes before everything kicks off.
Yeah, there's definitely some sort of things have kicked off when he arrives, which is great. And yeah, this is an episode, there's a lot of talk about the bland costumes, and you can't argue with that. Even when Herbert, obviously to be real later, he really is, turns up, he's in the same bland cream costume. It's very much a shade of vanilla across the entire set. The lack of colour is quite stark, I think.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it's the episode that fell under the budget constraints of the season. But even then, the only colour we really get are the Doctor's coat, the setting where Herbert is picked up, and the green lighting in the Borad's room, and that's about it.
Yeah, I quite like the stuff with the Borad, actually. It's quite effective and moody as well. That and the scenes of the Morlocks as well, the tunnels there. There are moments which feel quite effective, but the main set is a very bland, generic set. I definitely give them the criticisms they're due in terms of that sense.
Oh, yes, very much so. Because even the best stories have bad things. Not that I'm saying this is the best story ever. And then the worst stories have some great things in them most of the time as well.
Hmm. So yeah, a lot going on there. You've got this whole world building and the political schemes and the rebels and everything else going on. The Doctor and Perry arrive, and there's a lot of things converging at the same time. You've got the death of Maylin Redis, the kind of aging thing, which reminds me of, although I haven't seen it, the Daleks' master plan death of, is it Sarah Kingdom?
Yes, indeed it is. Having seen the reconstruction of that, I can't for certain say that's how it would be, but I might go as far to say the master plan death's probably a bit more effective.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's definitely cheap. The age into death, there's a few of them in this two-parter. They're definitely cheap, but they're quite fun too. I like the idea of it.
Oh yes, very much. And then is this just me, that when the skeletons hit the floor, there's a very satisfying bonk?
Quite possibly, yeah. It's certainly fun. I think the mystery around the Borad himself is quite good as well. I really like the voice for Robert Ashby. I think he has a really good voice as well. He's very effective, very menacing as well. So, yeah, the villain himself is quite... I'm actually really quite fond of the Borad in this story, even with the robbery effects later on, but we'll get to that. So, once we've established everything, we get the Doctor and Perry jiggling around in the TARDIS, and then the Vena pulled into the Time Lash as a traitor. So lots of going on, a little bit silly, a little bit cheap. My wife, Jem, Ben's mum, was watching a bit of it, and she went, that's enough of that now. I can't watch any more of this, and I had to leave the room. She found that quite cheap. It's a little bit silly. I agree with that. I don't think you can't really defend some of those camera jiggles in the TARDIS as well.
A lot of camera jiggles were actually quite a staple of the Sixth Doctor and late Fifth Doctor stories as well, so it's not just exclusive to here, although it probably is ramped up the furthest.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, when he arrives, you've got Paul Darrow, who may or know from Blake 7 as the ruthless, smarmy Tekko who becomes a Maylin. I really like Darrow in this story. It is an over-the-top performance, a very theatrical performance, but he does that right level of smarm perfectly, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see where you're coming from with that. It's a bit over-the-top, yes, but for the sort of person the character seems to be, and it's also a great contrast against Colin Baker's more abrasive Doctor.
Mm. I think actually the Colin Baker's Doctor's almost a little bit more reserved in this one, maybe against those more over-the-top performances.
Oh yeah, definitely. He's probably a bit louder and more as he was previously when he's alone with Perry in the TARDIS, as you see again later in part two. But against characters like Tekka, it's definitely toned down somewhat, which I think adds to the story's strengths.
Yeah, I think Baker's pretty decent in the story, actually, except maybe when he's being quite abrasive to Perry. But that's my issue with that relationship in general, right? And say I'm not a big fan of Perry as a companion, so maybe that's my... We talked about controversial opinions in the last episode. For me, I'm not a fan of Perry at all as a companion. Nothing against Nicola Bryant's performance, but I just find the character itself very whiny, and there is no one likeable in that TARDIS, which I think is for me, being one of the issues I have with the Sixth Doctor era.
As I saw someone say somewhere once, I'm not entirely sure where I saw, you definitely needed a third companion like Jamie and the two Doctors to add a layer of rounding towards their dynamic, put someone in the middle to stop the constant bickering.
Yeah, definitely. I think you need someone you can relate to. So Perry wasn't relatable because Perry was very whiny and kind of gave... She definitely gave as good as she got, but just because this constant bickering wasn't particularly fun to watch in any of the stories.
And especially as she doesn't have an awful lot to do in this story either. So that adds the character no favours for Time Lash.
Oh, I agree. I think Perry is very ill-served by the story. She's there to be the bride in that very sense of almost Phantom the Opera type esque storyline with the Borad. There's something at the end, but it's not particularly good. She's very much a damsel in distress in this one, just there to scream. But there are some good characters. There are over-the-top performances. Some of them work, some don't. I really like Paul Darrow's Tekka. There are some characters... The character plays Vina is a little bit hammy for me as well, so I definitely agree. Between the bland sets and the over-the-top performances, they're the things that do let it down. But I think the story has a huge amount of ambition, and I'd say I'm really fond of the script, particularly when you layer in the whole idea that this is a sequel to what essentially is a Third Doctor story. You get references to Joe and obviously later on the Muriel of the Third Doctor as well. And the idea that a Third Doctor's come to this planet with Joe in the past and been the hero, and now he's returned this kind of mythical figure, but the Borad, as you find out, is someone the Doctor went up against and is out for revenge now. So there's a really interesting personal dynamic to the story as well.
And indeed, it's a trope which you see quite a lot in classic Who, that the story that's broadcast on screen for you to watch is the sequel to an unseen adventure. Take Time Lash, The Abominable Snowman, The Celestial Toymaker, all of which the Doctor has been to this location or faced this enemy before, which you as the audience haven't seen.
Yeah, of course. But of course, talking about the Abominable Snowman, we miss without shouting out to our friend Andy Frankham-Allen, who has written the prequel to the Abominable Snowman for Big Finish, Secrets of Death's End. So definitely check that one out now. That's a little...
yep, coming out this month.
Well, as we record this, in August it comes out. I think this episode's probably going to go out in September, as we record it, definitely. Anyway, go back to Time Lash then. So there's a really interesting story, as you said there, with the Doctor's past and the kind of the influence he's had on the planet in general. But there's a lot more going on. There's also this conflict with the Bandrel. What are your thoughts on the Bandrel?
It's just harmless, isn't it? A nice little other alien design to add in, very much rubber, quite in the vein of the Pteroleptils from The Visitation, actually. Don't really speak much. Definitely background characters, but a fun addition nonetheless.
Yeah, it's very, very rubbery. It's quite cheap looking, but I like that it's not a humanoid alien. I like that there's something different that is attempted here, which Doctor Who does. I mean, in a way that Star Trek is the other big franchise, which is like Doctor Who can have multiple different styles of storytelling, relies very heavily on humanoid aliens. I like that Doctor Who doesn't. Doctor Who does weird and wonderful. And I think the Bandrel are definitely up there. They look a bit naff, but I think they work and they're different. And I certainly appreciate that. Again, the way I would start Time Lash, there's a really great ambition to the story there and lots of layers to the story. It's the execution that lets it down.
Yes, that is definitely where the glitch in the code lies, where the issues become more prominent and people like to pick at it to try and rip it apart.
Yeah, definitely. What are your thoughts on the androids with the blue faces?
They're almost off-putting in the sort of setting they're in, especially when you realise there's more than one of them, which I don't really ever make clear because budget means you can only show one at a time. Although, while their voices are quite high-pitched...
They're terrible.
Fair enough. You have that scene at one point where an android just pops up in a cave burning, and that's actually a really effective visual effect.
It is, I think, certainly, yeah. I think that's a nice little bit of, dare I say, going to Morondotsu, timey-wiminess that's thrown into the latter half of the script. So that's a real nice twist there. And again, that's why, the more I talk about this, the more when I was watching it, I'm actually really fond of the script, and I wish he'd done more. I think it's the execution that's let it down, not the ambition of the story itself. So yeah, things like that are really good. I think the androids, it's never really made clear that there are multiple androids because of budget saving. There's only ever one in the room at a time, but I don't know. Some, they look imposing in terms of how they're built, but when they're in light 80s pastels and bright yellow hair and blue faces and these really squeaky voices, it doesn't come together. There's nothing menacing about them.
You could very easily have them taken out the story and lose nothing.
Except, of course, the wonderful cliffhanger.
Yes, that is true.
I say wonderful, maybe that's a slightly sarcastic cliffhanger there. But before we get to that, then, there's quite a lot packed into that first episode. You've got Perry, she's shuffled around on tour, and then she's lured into the lair of the Morlocks, and then she's attacked by the beekeepers. The soldiers dressed as beekeepers in the episode, which I don't really understand. I do like that she attacks one with a shrubbery.
She demanded a shrubbery and attacked them with it.
Absolutely. Nice Monty Python reference there from you, Ben. So when she's loading the Morlocks, I think the set is actually quite effective. The set of the Morlocks, it's all studio-based, but there's certainly a sense of something a bit different compared to the very sterile corridors you get. And then you get the Morlock, which is it's better than the Murker. There are worse rubbery aliens on Doctor Who, but it's not one of the best.
Just another controversial opinion to throw in. I don't mind the Murker. But as you were saying, yeah, it's very much in vain of Invasion of the Dinosaurs with the design of the Morlock. Very like the big long neck and the rubbery head. So they're just harmless. They don't really add the threat they're meant to, but not everything can land.
No, but another nice dimension to the story. Yes, the other dimension to the story we have is, well, he's not called HD, is he? It's Herbert, the character played by David Chandler. So what do you think of Herbert in the story?
He very much gives off the vibes of Adric in the way he looks, almost the way he talks. In fact, he keeps stowing away on the TARDIS. Like, if there was any Doctor you're going to stow away with repeatedly, I wouldn't advise it be season 22-6. But oh well. But yeah, he's a very nice addition to the story.
Again, I really like the added element of the story. Yeah, something fresh. But I don't think it's really delivered that well, though. I think I love the idea that this is... Let's put it out there now. See, people have watched Time Lash, they know. Herbert is H.G. Wells before he became a successful writer. And the idea behind Time Lash, his experience in Time Lash, meeting the Doctor, stowing away on board the TARDIS and going to the future and seeing the Morlocks, is of course the inspiration for a time machine. And it's a really clever idea. Unfortunately, I think, I'm quite fond of David Chandler's performance. In the second half, it gets a little bit tiresome, a little bit too eager, but there were moments which I really like, that kind of almost innocent vibe. You're right, it's very Adric in that kind of innocent approach to the character. But it's a really nice, interesting idea that on top of, you didn't need it, but on top of what's going on the planet, you've also got H.G. Wells thrown into the mix, living his experiences through an encounter with the Doctor. I think that's really, really cleverly done. Unfortunately, I don't think the episode then does much with that. I don't think he has really any agency once he stows on board in the second half, apart from the rescue of Perry. He's just there to witness.
Although he does have some quite interesting interactions with the Doctor, basically being dismissed the whole time.
Yeah, I quite like those performances with the Doctor. I like, again, I really like Colin Baker in the scenes when he meets Herbert back in the 1895, I believe it is, or maybe 1885, I think it is, where he follows Vina, who's been pulled into the past through a time lash as well. I love the Doctor. Hello, have you seen a rather surprised young lady? That's almost a very Tom Baker-esque type performance there. And I think he's really good in that scene. And there's some really good interactions between them. And again, I really like Herbert's enthusiasm about the TARDIS, and there's a nice little interplay of that classic, it's bigger than the inside. Yes, I know it's bigger than the inside. There's some real kind of fun scenes there, and actually I would have quite liked to have seen Herbert still on the TARDIS. Talk about having that third character. Imagine had Herbert stayed on the TARDIS after Time Lash and been another companion with Perry and the Doctor. I think that would have been a real kind of fun dynamic.
You either would have had Six being driven out of his mind by Herbert being really inquisitive and Perry whining, or Six and Perry might have come closer together because Herbert was there to stop the constant bickering that goes on between the two.
Absolutely. Have there been any stories where you've had Herbert, Six Doctor and Perry on the TARDIS after this?
Those three, I don't believe we have. No, Big Finish, get onto it.
Absolutely, I'd like to see that. Of course, again, talking about Kanjar books, which I've written for as well, and I'll talk about in a minute, that there are some really great books from Kanjar books. He wrote a lot of the Lethbridge Stewart stories, which is a Doctor Who spin-off range, and there are the stories Travers and Wells, which is basically H.G. Wells and Professor Travers, who appeared in the two great intelligent stories, The Abominable Snowman, which you mentioned before, and The Web of Fear, off on adventures together, and they're really good, because good fun stories there that basically continue. It's a slightly different Wells, but essentially it's the Wells who experience what happened in Time Lash, going on further adventures, experiencing things like the Mars invasion, which became War of the Worlds, and, you know, really experiencing some of these stories. The character of Wells in Doctor Who does continue to have these kind of outer world experiences which influence his books.
Yeah, definitely so. And it would be really nice to have seen him have some more agency to the story. Like, you never actually see the Doctor drop him off. You can easily slot one or two stories in between the ending of Time Lash and the Doctor trying to bring Herbert back to his own time period.
Absolutely. Maybe this story should have come earlier in the season and had H.G. Wells in a couple more stories.
Now that would have been a good idea.
Yes.
Very good, actually.
Yeah. How would you experience Vengeance on Varos? That would be an interesting one. It's a pretty nasty story.
Oh, no. Poor Herbert. He would not have lasted in that.
No, not at all. Actually, interesting fact. For those who don't know, I've also written a Lethbridge Stewart novel, Forward to the Past, which is from the Series 7 range of the Lethbridge Stewart books from Kanjar Books. And one of the original ideas that Andy Frankamara and I discussed, we were going to have H.G. Wells as part of the storyline. He got dropped early, didn't quite work, got dropped early on, but it was going to be take from the idea from those Travers and Wells and have H.G. Wells as one of the characters in that story, in which was going to be what became the Paris sequence for those who may have read the book. I'd like to have written for that character, but he did get dropped quite early on, I think for the right reasons too, but yeah, maybe one day I'll write for him. So getting back to Time Lash then, we get that the only real cliffhanger of the episode is only a two-parter, as Colin is dragged towards a Time Lash after being betrayed by Tekka and the android dragging him towards his certain doom. What do you think of that cliffhanger?
You very much get one of the iconic Colin in pain faces from season 22. It's like the season 22 rival of the face zooms in Trial of a Time Lord.
There's a lot of face zooms, aren't there, of Colin Baker in that
scene. That's basically the end of every episode of Trial.
Zoom! Colin Baker's face, yeah. What's the Sixth Doctor going to react to next? Absolutely, yeah. It's not great. I feel like I've been praising Colin Baker, saying this is one of his better episodes throughout this podcast. And, of course, I can't defend the Sixth Doctor in pain cliffhanger. It's a little bit naff.
Fair enough. They needed a way to pause it for a minute, especially because the resolution, he basically then goes into the Time Lash 5 minutes later anyway.
Well, he does, but first he distracts the android with a mirror and some honky-tonk music, so that's an interesting way to resolve the cliffhanger.
Up, down, face the mirror, android.
Yeah, it doesn't work, does it? Doctor Who had this issue sometimes. I love Doctor Who cliffhangers. It's a common staple of almost every Doctor Who story, because Doctor Who stories in the classic era were multi-episode stories. You know, it was 3, 4, 6, 8, even 10 at times. You know, right. So it'll be a 12, yeah. So, yeah, and some of them were too long, absolutely. But because you always had the classic 4 or 6-part story, it gave the opportunity to have cliffhangers. Something that I really enjoyed when he got around to series 9 of Doctor Who with Capaldi and Clara, then it fall back to those cliffhangers.
Especially especially considering series 13 is going to be all one story, so it's confirmed every episode bar episode 6, I imagine, is going to end on a cliffhanger.
Which I'm quite looking forward to. I like a good multi-story cliffhanger there. This one isn't one of the best, though, is it? I think Colin's pain face is a little bit naff, and then the whole resolution, it just fizzles out. And the trouble with having so many big cliffhangers every like three or four times in a story is they're not all going to pay off, and sometimes they're resolved in the flattest way possible. And this one is just a bit ridiculous.
Because sometimes you'll get, like in the Sontaran experiment, Steyr being like, I think Steyr's Sontaran experiment, him being like, and now I will kill you, and then it's credits. And at the beginning of episode 2, he's like, but later, first I have some tasks to perform.
Definitely, yeah. Some don't work as well as others. It's a bit of a naff cliffhanger, but of course then the Doctor does go into the Time Lash to retrieve some crystals. So, Time Lash, is it cheap or cool design?
Personally, I quite like it. It definitely looks cheap, and you can see the crystals visibly wobble under Colin, and sometimes some of the tinsel leaves on the walls, I think, flashes past the camera. But overall, it's a very inventive set that they've tried to accomplish here.
Yeah, I think if you take out the Christmas tinsel, which is very evident in Time Lash, it does a very good job of making what is obviously a horizontal set seem vertical. Again, it's the execution, and maybe with a better budget, I don't know. I mean, Doctor Who did suffer with poor budget, even on some of the best stories, so that's one thing that modern Doctor Who can do better, and that's just the nature of film, of TV making today. But I think it does a fairly decent job with what it's got. I do like the set with the different crystals and the shards of rock coming out as well. And I think it's done very well. And I think it's a great little sequence, even if it maybe could have some mist or kind of colour effect on the top to make it a bit more. It doesn't really feel like they're jumping through a portal, but it still works for me. And of course, after that, you start to get the reveals around Borat himself. So Dennis Carey's old man, you find out that actually he's plugged in. He's just the face of the Borad. What do you think of that twist?
It's very much in the vein of the Macro Terror, if anyone's seen the animation, the photo reconstruction, or even those of you who may have seen it broadcast back in 1967, when you see the face of the controller is used as the face for the colony, but actually the giant crabs are behind the whole thing. You get the similar vein here with the android, at least I assume he's an android, man broadcast across Carthel, used as the voice of the people, if he actually takes that into account. But then actually you've got the mutant man in the crystally chair behind the whole thing, which, it's definitely a nice idea and adds more to the whole, who is this evil villain in the chair you only see the back of for ages storyline.
Yeah. It's a great little villain behind the chair moment, actually. I'm quite fond of that. I'm quite fond of all those scenes with the Borad in his kind of control room as well. And of course, you get the second of the de-aging deaths when poor Kendron is used by a scapegoat by Tekka and killed. And I think this is where Tekka's really at his most smarmiest, because Tekka really is a nasty piece of work. He's really arrogant, and yeah, he's as much a villain of the story as the Borad himself.
Definitely, yes, but he's definitely not the most evil person there is, because as you see later on, when the Borad reveals his plan to kill everyone, Tekka's like, well, hold on, no, you're not going to kill all my people.
Yeah, and then dies the most satisfying death possible.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a very satisfying death, actually. I quite like that. I guess in the build-up to that confrontation with the Borad then, you've got, I say, we talk about Perry not having much to do, and she doesn't have much to do here. She's tethered around on a leash around her neck for what seems like 17 hours. It just seems she's got on and on and on of her being dragged around by these beekeepers. Maybe they're angry because she threw a shrubbery at them, I don't know. And then she becomes food for the Morlocks. Well, you think it's food for the Morlocks. You find it's a little bit more insidious as it goes on.
Yeah, but it's just Perry being menaced by a rubber head and her screaming.
Yes, and the head gets closer and closer and closer and closer and closer and closer and closer to her. And how do the Morlocks eat or kill anyone? Because they seem impossibly slow.
Yeah, that's true. I guess They have to rely on their fear factor of everyone being terrified of them, not doing the smart thing and immediately running away.
Yeah, in Classic Doctor Who, a lot of people faint, so maybe that works in their favour too.
Yeah, possibly. Maybe they're just waiting for some of the Doctor's lesser companions to show up so they can finally eat something.
Quite possibly, yeah. So, you've got a really good scene here as well, once the Doctor's out of the time lash, and he's used the Cantron crystals to build this kind of... How do you describe it? It's basically a way of... It's a time distortion device, isn't it? So he can jump 10 seconds into the past.
The illusion of the Doctor sitting somewhere where actually he's walking around pushing people over and fiddling with devices, and then the image of him following suit. It's a very nice way of doing things, actually, and it's probably one of my favourite things about Time Lash, the inventiveness of the Doctor here to use a very unique device in order to help overthrow the evil dictator and help the people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a Doctor using his wits about him to kind of come up with a clever solution. And the Doctor is clever, and he's going to come up with ideas and concepts that most people wouldn't do. But you want to see him be clever and be able to outwit the bad guys. And I think this episode definitely demonstrates his ability to do that.
Oh, very much so. Six is definitely one of the more inventive Doctors, probably only really rivaled by Pertwee. Probably because he didn't have a sonic screwdriver to get him out of all these situations. He had to turn to other ways to help himself and the others around him.
Yeah, you can imagine a sonic screwdriver would have kind of solved a lot of problems had it been around in this episode. You talk about event as well. That's one thing, you know, I know we're going to talk about it in probably in a couple of episodes time, but the inventor Doctor is kind of one of my favourite concepts. I really like the 13th Doctor as well. You don't see much of it, but I like the moments with the 13th Doctor when you saw her invent, you know, in the 31st episode and then in Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror as well. It was a really good idea. It was showing her being the inventor, and that was really great.
Not to mention Demons of the Punjab as well, building with the Jarian detector.
Yeah, no, I like it when you see the Doctor being an inventor. It shows the level of thinking they are, but kind of beyond the skill, beyond everyone else. So, yeah, it's nice to see that Doctor here. You tend to find a lot with the Sixth Doctor on TV that he's just in there being rude, arrogant, responding to an incredibly violent situation, and then turn up at the last minute and basically just outwitting
the opposition.
The opposition, yeah. But you don't see a lot of him really being the hero. It's very reactive to what's going on. And I like this story. He's very, very proactive. Perry is completely reactive to what's going on. She has no agency whatsoever. And unfortunately, neither does Herbert, even though he's a nice addition to the episode. But it's nice to see the Doctor really kind of there in the middle of action, really taking action to resolve the situation.
Mm. In fact, I'd go as far to say, other than maybe stories like Mysterious Planet, which isn't a good episode, this might be the Sixth Doctor's best episode for him driving the plot, helping solve everything. Because yes, while Perry does suffer from literally nothing to do, I think that works in the Doctor's favour for this story and definitely shows what the Sixth Doctor could have been had the BBC not lost all their faith in him.
Yeah, I think it's a good Sixth Doctor story. It definitely shows him at his best. And of course, talking of Doctors, you've also got the Muir there, the Third Doctor as well, so you've got a bit of Pertwee, which I guess at the time, this is something that Pertwee's Doctor wouldn't have been seen by fans for years at this point, so it's a nice little kind of Easter egg to the early Doctor Who.
Well, you say that, there was the Five Doctors about 2 years before this,
true.
But then before that, yeah, he hadn't been seen since Planet of the Spiders. Because fans tend to take for granted these days just a reference to, oh look, they've referenced the Seventh Doctor, or there's a picture of David Tennant. When in Classic Who, that was a lot more rare to see, and it's much nicer fan service than constant, oh, we're getting Daleks every season, which Classic Who didn't do.
Yeah, of course. And the other thing we take for granted now is we can go and watch a John Pertwee episode or a William Hartnell episode, or we can listen to some some Eighth Doctor audios or more Sixth Doctor. We've got so much access to Doctor Who classic and new now that if you want to reminisce about your favourite Doctor from your childhood, you just go put a DVD on and watch it. Whereas back then, maybe fans of the Third Doctor, apart from the Five Doctors, which was a couple of years before, they wouldn't have seen much of their favourite Doctor for years and years and years. So it's a nice little kind of remembrance of an earlier era in the show.
Because, yeah, there might have been VHS tapes starting to release around that time. I'm 15 right now. I would have no idea how much they released in the 80s.
You know what a VHS tape is, though?
Oh, yeah, I know what that is. Don't worry. I read Doctor Who magazine. But, yeah, people might have been able to have the occasional VHS to go and watch an old episode, but probably not in great quality. Or maybe you wouldn't have been able to at all. Because Time Lash definitely does that really nice fanservice-y thing of allowing you to reminisce over the Third Doctor or Joe and come up with the story in your own head of what maybe he did before, adding to the mythos of the Doctor.
Definitely. Okay, so let's move on then to the Borod reveal then. So we finally get to see the Borod in all his slimy glory then with the death of Tekka. And we find that he was his scientist. I think he's called Magellan.
Yes, yeah. I believe that's what the Doctor said.
Experimented on the Morlocks and then was stopped by, we assume, the Third Doctor. And now he's planning to populate the planet with people like him as a result, following the death and destruction caused by the Bandrel invasion. So there's definitely some stakes being raised here, but also a nice personal connection with the Doctor as well.
Yeah, definitely. Plus, the Borod design isn't too shabby either. Like, the weird mutated hand claw thing looks a bit papery, but honestly, like, the face is not a bad design. It is actually quite good and probably where most of the budget for this story went into, which definitely works in its favour.
Yeah, I love the Borod design. I think it's great. It's a little bit rubbery, but the idea of that kind of clawed, scaly hand and that kind of the half almost like salamander-type face over the human face is really effectively done.
The slimy lizard man plotting away behind the scenes. It definitely fits his character.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And of course, you've got this possibly ludicrous, I don't know, subplot then of Perry, who's going to become his mate by the... So you see, the Morlock's going to attack Perry, the gas is going to be released that's tied to her, and it's going to transform her, killing the Morlock, and half-transform her into half-human, half-Morlock, and she'll become his mate, so...
Exactly. Why do all the Colin Baker stories really want to do this to Perry? I'm fairly sure, like, Big Finish do it as well, but if you look on TV, Vengeance on Varos tried to do that as well, turning her into a bird woman. Just leave Perry alone, even if she doesn't have anything to do. She doesn't deserve this.
No, she does. She doesn't, certainly. And of course, then you get to try the Time Lord, and you can pick your ending. I actually prefer the darker ending that you get in the second story, as opposed to that kind of very wishy-washy, oh, she suddenly marries Brian Blessed ending. But
yeah, definitely. Because again, sort of keep talking about Big Finish, but they have a story, Perry and the Piscon Paradox, which is actually a very good story, where they reveal there are like five different versions of Perry, so technically both of those endings are true.
Cool. It's an interesting one. I never liked how they kind of retroactively gave her a happy ending, and then I think it actually worked better with that kind of slightly darker ending, but there you go. So yeah, Perry suffers. She's the victim of many a maniacal plan, and depends on where you look at it. Maybe that's her ultimate fate too.
Actually, Showers Jack tried to do that in Caves of Androni. It's not even limited to her Sixth Doctor stories.
No, not at all. So, I guess you've got the Doctor using a 10-second delay to destroy the Borod and age him to death, which is quite clever. And then Herbert rescues Perry from the Morlocks. It's the only thing he really does in this episode, isn't it? Is his rescue of Perry. He's far too much of an observer from why I like him.
Which obviously, I think that is partly the point of his character here, to take these experiences in so he does write the time machine. But he could definitely have a bit more agency, but he definitely has a lot more to do than Perry waving the torch in front of the rubber.
Which doesn't melt, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think this is where I think this first half of the second episode is probably the strongest part. Up to the first defeat of the Borat, it's really effective. But then you've got this missile from the Bandor attacking the planet. This missile seems to take forever and ever and ever to come. And the Doctor, he tries to use his title as President of Gallifrey, so a nice bit of continuity there, to stop the Bandor attack, but can't do it. So he uses the TARDIS to essentially... You never really explain how the TARDIS survives. She was just shield him, but use the TARDIS to block the path of the missile and destroy it in the atmosphere.
Oh yeah, the Doctor says like he deflects the missile, but it would still destroy the TARDIS. And then we get that explanation later on of, oh, it's a neat trick, I'll explain someday. Which to me does feel like slightly lazy writing, that Glenn McCoy wanted to add this final stakes in with the missile, but then wasn't really sure what to do with it. Because if he wasn't sure how to resolve it, just don't say that it would still destroy the TARDIS, and then it's simple. But no, you sort of leave it on that, oh, well, how did he survive? Which is probably the worst thing about the story for me, that little bit of unsatisfaction, which might seem a bit nitpicky, but I like the story, so...
Yeah, you can kind of get away in Doctor Who. The Doctor can get out of the impossible odds. He's one character on TV that can do it. It's probably going to be the Doctor. But just saying, oh, it's a clever thing, but we're not going to show you, is a bit of a cop-out, certainly. But I guess, for me, I find the whole TARDIS scenes really tedious. As much as I do quite enjoy the Herbert and Doctor relationship, you know, I would love to have seen Herbert as a companion to the Doctor. He does come a little bit so eager and irritating, particularly when the stakes are so high. All you have is Doctor and Perry arguing just to fill time. And then you've got Herbert just being so over-eager that he goes from quite endearing to quite irritating very quickly as well.
Yeah, I could definitely... He definitely keeps on giving off the Adric vibes there. Mm. And, like, while the Fifth Doctor was quite bored with Adric and never really liked him, it would be interesting to see just how the Sixth Doctor would react to this character. Adric keeping on whining on and acting really smart. I doubt Six would really have time for any of it. And you see that in these scenes with Herbert throughout the episode where, like, Herbert's like, oh, Doctor, don't be worried about me. And he's just like, yeah, I'm not. Or when the Doctor says, trust me, Herbert, on the event of our imminent deaths, thoughts of you will be very low in my mind.
Yeah.
Which is a bit mean, but it fits.
It won't. They're the moments I like. There's just too much of it. I think it feels to me like the TARDIS scenes are there. I think they ran short on time, so they added the TARDIS scenes in, and they just go on and on and on and on. They should have been 2 minutes, and they feel like 10. I'm not sure how long they actually are. They certainly feel like 10 minutes of time just to build up to fill the space of the episode. But of course, then you get the whole the Doctor's dead, oh no, and then the Borra turns up to claim Perry. What did you think of that final confrontation when the villain comes back for one last kill, shall we say?
It is definitely quite a nice surprise as well, like, oh, okay, hold on, we're not done yet, the Borat's actually back, and then it's quite satisfying that the people then get to see him for who he is, and that last confrontation between the Doctor and the Borat being like, well, everyone's going to be disgusted by you. Even if you change Perry's outward appearance, she's never going to love you. And it just raises the anxiety and the fear in the Borat of being alone forever. And that's his ultimate downfall, which is great.
Yeah. I think maybe you're more fond of this than I am. I think the whole idea... There's certainly tragedy in the Borat, but they've built up to be this ruthless villain that it's hard to really care that he might be alone and someone love him for who he is. Because he is pretty... gruesome for his own design, for the experimentation that he's done. I find it hard to feel for the board of that.
Oh yeah, I don't feel for him either. I'm just saying the way the Borat ends up being defeated because of his own fear of being alone, when it's very obvious no one is going to want to be with him, it's quite a nice way of ending it for him, despite the fact no one's going to have emotional feelings for the Borat. Even 10 minutes down the line.
No, not at all. Because then he's chucked into the time lash, the time lash is destroyed, and presumably he goes on to be a living legend in 12th century Scotland.
You say that. There's an 8th Doctor novel, The Taking of Planet 5, I believe, which seems just like a canonical plaster for the Scarison being the Loch Ness Monster, where you learn that upon immediately arriving in Loch Ness, the Borad is assassinated. Which, poor Borad. Not that I have feelings for the Borad, as I've just said, but a bit of a harsh death.
Just like yeah, it's slightly harsh maybe, but yeah. I didn't really buy the whole idea that he then becomes a legend of the Loch Ness Monster, particularly as you've had the whole thing with the Zygons in the Tom Baker era too, which is done far better.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's really become the end of the story. So H.D. Wells, as you've revealed who he actually is, he, as much as he wants to stay, the Doctor says he's going to come back for him because he's going to write these books. And he does continue to write his many adventures, with which Time Lash is the inspiration for the Time Machine.
Hmm. I quite like the Doctor's last little monologue where he's like, well, you know, he is going to tell his story. He's going to go on to be this famous figure. And it's quite a nice, satisfying last twist ending. Like, oh, okay, that's quite a good thing. Nice idea? Yes.
Yeah. I just wish they'd done more with H.G. Wells, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Not that same time I should have been a six-parter. I think very few episodes were on six-parters, but yeah. I think maybe you could have taken half that TARDIS stuff and given H.G. Wells something to do, maybe.
Yeah, ultimately, if you split it into the 25-minute chunks, it's your average four-parter. Well, I say average. You either love it or hate it, really.
Yeah. So, any other thoughts on Time Lash?
It is certainly an underrated story, overhated, and yes, there are elements which definitely don't work, but people seem to sleep on those elements and not really account for the greatness of the ambition and the plot. They just look at the execution and dismiss it as this boring filler story, when actually it's quite fun, and it's got some great moments in it. And it really cements the Sixth Doctor as the Doctor he is throughout pretty much the rest of his run. This is where he definitely starts to properly 100% take on the role of being a central character. Like, you could argue the Two Doctors was the one that properly started it, but I say Time Lash is definitely where everything starts revolving around him.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good Sixth Doctor story. I think it's got great ambition. I like the elements of H.G. Wells. Even it's not executed as well as I would like. I really like the Borad too. There's some really great elements here and they're real great ambition. So I think we can confidently say we've won our case in defence of Time Lash.
Not the best story in the world, but by no means the worst. There are plenty of worse stories in Time Lash. And who knows, give it another go. You may find you enjoy it more.
Absolutely, there you go, that's our defence of Time Lash. Next time, we're going to cherry pick some classics as we take a look at the best of each Doctor, their best stories, their best companions, and the highlights of each one. Looking forward to that?
Indeed I am. Probably where some more controversial opinions will come to light.
Yeah, maybe one person's favourite, maybe another person's hated episode, you never know.
Oh yeah, and I definitely think quite a lot of loved stories are overrated. So, let's just say, don't expect to see some greats like Talons of Weng Triang on my list anywhere.
We shall see. But we've both got opinions to make, and hopefully you'll agree with some of them. Thanks for joining us. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to the TARDIS crew and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to help out our network, please consider supporting us on Patreon if you go to patreon.com/wemadethis. Doctor Who is not all we're discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in a moment. As I said, next time we'll be taking the best of each Doctor. So join us again for the TARDIS crew, because somewhere there's danger, somewhere there's injustice, and somewhere else the tea's getting cold.
Elsewhere, and We Made This. Podcast 616, a Marvel Universe podcast.
I definitely noticed that they weren't the actual voice actors. It didn't bother me. It didn't feel strange or anything. I mean, we as viewers have become so accustomed to seeing, you know, Chris Pratt as Star-Lord, or Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa, or Dave Bautista as Drax, that in these instances, when we hear their voices and they don't necessarily match, it's like, oh, wait a second, you know, that's not the right person. But you know, stepping outside of it for a moment, you know, these are comic book characters. We're introducing the multiverse, right? And now we are introducing all of these tangents of stories that can go in any different kind of direction. So they don't need to be the same actor. They don't need to be the same voice one-to-one, in my mind. And as a fan, I can accept this. I'm okay with that.
The Movie Palace Podcast.
Yeah, is Truffaut somebody you found yourself drawn to over the years? Have you watched, like, a lot of his films?
So, just in terms of, like, French New Wave, I think I've seen more Jean-Luc Godard than I've seen François Truffaut. But I really do love François Truffaut. I love his attention to realism and to small aspects of people's lives. And I love his stories and how character-driven they are. I've seen, like, Shoot the Piano Player, Jules and Jim, which isn't one of my favorites, but I'm trying to appreciate it more.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Craig Charles looks f***ing cool as Sebastian Doyle. I'd love to look that cool. Oh, bad.
Craig Charles tends to look cool all of the time, though.
Well, true, but he looks more sophisticated cool than rocker dude with a band cool. And I'm getting old. I want to look sophisticated cool rather than rocker dude cool.
Craig Charles had apparently said that, you know, it was great to be able to play this version of Lister because that's more like me. Or is he being the cool guy? which I thought was great.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.